This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, we'll talk about indigenous methods of wildfire management, and we'll talk with director Rick Burns about his new biography of Oliver Sacks. But first, the race for the COVID-19 vaccine is heating up. Just this week, Johnson & Johnson announced its vaccine is entering a final stage of clinical trials, making it the fourth U.S. company to do so. So what does this mean for when an actual vaccine makes it to a major muscle of mine? Here with me to talk about this and other news from the week is Sarah Zhang, staff writer at The Atlantic in Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Good to talk to you.
Nice to have you. Okay, let's start with what's going on with a COVID-19 vaccine. What does it mean that four vaccines are in phase 3 trials?
Yeah, so phase 3 trials are the last step before final approval. And so these are really large trials that have tens of thousands of people. From the protocols that have been released, these trials will probably take a few months themselves. So it'll probably take a few more months before we really know any of these vaccines are effective and safe. But after that, state and local health departments are kind of preparing for what they've called the largest, most complex vaccination program they've ever had to do in their history. And that has to do, one, with just the sheer scale of trying to vaccinate hundreds of millions of Americans. And second, has to do with the kind of the particular characteristics of some of the leading vaccine candidates, especially the two that are furthest along in clinical trials. So they use a new technology that is just both new, and also the vaccines themselves are extremely physically fragile, which means that they just have to be kept at really low freezer temperatures, as low as negative 94 degrees Fahrenheit.
Isn't that going to be a problem if you have to keep a vaccine at negative 94 Fahrenheit? How do you move it around?
Yeah, exactly. This is what people are trying to figure out right now. They're trying to draw up plans for this right now. So, you know, if you are a large hospital in the city, you probably have a deep freezer that can go down to negative 94 degrees Fahrenheit. So Pfizer, who makes a vaccine that needs to be kept this cold, they've actually been working on making these what they call thermal shippers, which are these kind of pizza box size boxes of vaccines that can ship them out in dry ice and hopefully keep them for, you know, 10 days or so. One of the issues, and this is one of those things that is going to sound small until you really delve into details, is that these boxes hold at a minimum about 1,000 doses of vaccine. And again, this is like fine if you're a large hospital in a large city, but if you're trying to think about, you know, vaccinating all of the doctors at rural clinics in a large state, now you're getting into, well, how do I distribute these really cold vaccines across a really large state, right? So in North Dakota, for example, the health department told me that they are literally thinking about buying a dry ice machine and then, you know, physically driving these vaccines around the state at first.
Yeah, that's what my next question was. You'd need a lot of dry ice if you think about it nationally. If you're going to distribute all of this, is there going to be a shortage of dry ice?
I had the exact same question. So there is actually a current short of dry ice, because dry ice is actually kind of a byproduct of ethanol production. So it's kind of made through the off gas when you make gasoline. So there hasn't been a lot of driving in the past few months, or there's been less driving than usual because of the lockdown. So there's been a little bit less dry ice than usual. The industry tells me that they think that they have capacity to ramp up production by the time the vaccine actually comes around. So hopefully that's the case.
Hopefully. Okay, we'll keep watching that. Let's move on to a COVID-19 adjacent story. And this is really interesting. A lockdown has actually changed the bird song for some birds in California.
Yeah, exactly. So these are sparrows in and around San Francisco. So I think when we first started sheltering in place, I remember people saying, hey, like, are you hearing more birds? Are the birds louder? So a bunch of scientists in San Francisco actually went out and quantified this, and they did find that their songs did change. They were actually quieter, and that's because there was less traffic around. And the other change it made is that, you know, traffic is kind of this, like, you know, usually this like kind of low rumbly sound, right? So without traffic, birds didn't have to try to sing higher, like higher pitch to kind of talk over the traffic the way you might try to talk really loudly at a party when there's a lot of background noise. So these birds were actually singing differently based on kind of old recordings they did. This was kind of how they sang back in the 1970s when the city was less loud.
That's really cool. I wonder whether when COVID is over and traffic comes back, whether these bird songs are going to change their tune again.
Yeah, I hope that they're recording their songs right now. I think what we saw is that birds can change their songs fairly quickly and adapt to their environment. And I have, you know, if I were to guess, I think they do that again once we start driving cars and going outside and, you know, cutting construction back up.
They seem very flexible. Let's stay in California for this next story, but move to climate change related news. And that is about the state's governor, Gavin Newsom, signing an executive order that will ban the sale of gasoline-powered cars by 2035. That sounds like a pretty big deal.
Yeah, it is a pretty big deal. California has kind of historically been a real leader in car emissions. In the past, for example, they've set car emission standards that have been stricter than the rest of the country. And what ends up happening is that if you're a large, you know, if you're a car manufacturer, you don't want to make one car for California and then one car for the rest of the country. So they end up following California's kind of stricter regulations. California is also the world's fifth largest economy. So whatever they do tends to have a lot of sway. And, you know, this is a kind of a big deal for California to jump out in front of this in the U.S. But if you look at the larger global context, several other countries in Europe, as well as China and India, have also set similar goals of phasing out gas-powered cars in the next decade or two.
Now, does this seem like it's related at all to the terrible wildfire season that the state has been going through this year?
Yeah, it's a good question. So Governor Newsom, when he signed the executive order, did in fact mention the fact that, you know, wildfires have been all over California this year. And actually not these natural disasters, it's not just California, right? It's also the rest of the country. We are in a hurricane season where we've gone through an entire alphabet and are now back to the Greek alphabet. So I think that all throughout the country, you're seeing these disasters that are being amplified by climate change. And obviously car emissions is a big factor in, you know, carbon output.
You know, we've already seen the Trump administration push back against California car regulations before. I'm imagining we might see this even on a larger scale, considering the size of the effort that Gavin Newsom is talking about.
Yeah, exactly. I think we can expect that too. You know, the stricter car emissions I was talking about earlier from California, those are being challenged in court. So I think we can expect that this phase out of gas-powered cars is probably also going to be something that the courts will look at.
All right, let's move on to a story from the other side of the world. And that's about researchers in Iran found something interesting in the desert. What did they find?
They found shrimp. And you might be wondering, what are shrimp doing in the desert? Don't they need water? So this is a new species of fairy shrimp. And what happens is, you know, the desert, obviously, there's usually no water. It's very dry. But when it rains, sometimes you get these large lakes of water that show up. And this is when these tiny dried eggs of the shrimp that may have been sitting there for maybe decades, this is when they hatch and they come out. And they're these kind of small, feathery little crustaceans. And they swim around and then they mate and then they die. And their eggs will hopefully hatch again when it rains again.
Can you eat them? I mean, are they harvesting them for food?
I don't think I don't know if they're that tasty. They're not, you know, we call them fairy shrimp, but they're actually not that closely related to the shrimp and like prawns that we buy at the grocery store and that we eat. But they are kind of remarkable. They look almost a little insect-like.
Well, you know, if there can be so much life in the Great Salt Lake in Utah, shrimp growing there, I imagine the shrimp are pretty hardy and can find other places to grow in hostile climates.
Yeah, well, they do have a very strange life cycle, right? They like live in, as you say, this desert in Iran, which is one of the hottest spots in the world. It can get as high as 160 degrees Fahrenheit. One of the scientists who was interviewed about his discovery, he was just talking about how hard it was to work in this desert. And these shrimp survived there. And the reason they actually even discovered the shrimp was that it was just so hot. And they found this body of water and started wading in. And that's when they noticed all these little white creatures around their legs.
That is a hot, cool story.
Indeed.
If I can phrase it that way. One last story. Unfortunately, we're not getting the Tokyo Olympics this summer, but still a world record for diving has been smashed by a whale. Are we talking about a double somersault with a half twist on this here?
We don't know, but I can tell you how long it was. So this is a beaked whale, which was recorded to have been underwater for 3 hours and 42 minutes, which is just remarkable, you know, because whales are also mammals. They also need oxygen. So they're somehow swimming underwater for almost 4 hours without needing to breathe. So this is a species called the beaked whale, which spends a lot of its time underwater. So they are kind of a mysterious and enigmatic creature. And this is one of the first times we've had a large scale study of how often and how long these whales dive. And, you know, most of them are not spending almost 4 hours underwater. Most of the time it's only, half an hour to 2.5 hours. But it seems to have gone on as long as 3 hours and 42 minutes.
You know, that's one of the great mysteries about mammals that live in the ocean and other animals like seals is how they can hold their breath for so long and survive underwater for hours, and what's going on inside their bodies that we can't do.
Yeah, exactly. So there are some theories. One is that maybe these whales are able to shunt blood away from their guts and their organs to their brains and their muscles so that, you know, they're kind of not wasting oxygen in parts of their bodies they're not using. Also, their muscles might be slightly different. They might be better at tolerating kind of the toxins that would normally build up if we weren't breathing for a while. But, you know, the real answer is we don't know. These whales, we don't see them very often. They don't come up to the surface very often. But they're somehow managing to survive without having to breathe for 3 hours and 42 minutes.
I'd love to see how they know how to do this. Thank you very much.
Yeah, great to be here. Good to talk to you.
Great stuff, Sarah. Sarah Zhang, staff writer at The Atlantic in Washington, D.C.